All right. First of all, I'm recording. First of all, there is a problem with the textbook. For those of you who are following along the selection versus migration material, and following in the text, you may have been confused because the text goes along talking about multiple populations exchanging migrants, and then in the middle of a sentence, suddenly it's talking about selection versus migration without a change of heading or anything. Well, a page and a half of the text disappeared there, so I found it in an older version and restored it. So if you want to read that material, go to the online version that's linked, the one that's linked to from the course website, and you will see. It affects things like section numbering and equation numbering in a consistent way, so within each version of the text there's not a problem, but between them you'll find the same section might be numbered two different numbers. Once I restore, though, the page and a half is restored in the online version now, and it will make sense. Okay. So, where we're up to is, I was talking to you about a local adaptation on an island with migration coming in from the continent at rate M. You had fitnesses, 1 to 1 minus S, and the upshot of it all was that the equilibrium frequency of big A, the locally adapted, the locally favored allele, where all of the migrants coming in had the other allele, the non-locally favored allele, was 1 minus M over S. And basically that means that if there's more migration, the frequency of the locally adapted allele gets lower, up to a point when the migration rate equals the selection coefficient. Any case larger than that, what will actually happen is the influx of alleles from the continent will swamp the local adaptation. So this is an example of a patch of adaptation collapsing under too much migration, but under somewhat less migration, it will be at least partially differentiated. There's another, this was a haploid case, but if you take the diploid case of multiplicative selection like this, where the fitnesses are in a geometric series, which we do just because it's convenient mathematically. Its math is identical, so I won't even do any equations here. It's got the same exact math. It has the same exact property of the collapse of the patch of adaptation. A more bizarre case is when the local adaptation is recessive. Now, S doesn't, you see the S is a little different here. It's the big A that's favored locally, but in a recessive way. And you may recall, you should recall, that in a case where one genotype, where one allele is recessive, if the gene frequency of that allele gets low, then since those alleles don't run into each other very often, that selection doesn't get very much chance to act. So in this case, things get a little more complicated. Now, I won't do the math. It's in the notes. But I'll just show you the diagram that you get. And now remember, this is not a time sequence of events. These are different migration rates, so they're different cases. So we consider an island with a certain migration rate in from the continent. We consider a different island with a different migration rate. And if the selection were the same, those would be the different cases horizontally. I'm plotting the frequency of the locally adapted allele. In this case, we're calling it big A. By the way, there's no law that says that a capital letter allele cannot be recessive. And in textbooks, invariably, the small letters are recessive, but the labels are arbitrary. Now, the interesting thing that this has, the interesting property that this has is If you start out with no migration, that of course would be a case where Big A fixes on the island. It's quite happy. And then if you consider more and more migration, each case that you look at has less, lower and lower frequency of the favored allele, and it comes down in a curving, almost a parabola, curving down. But then an interesting fact is that there is an unstable equilibrium curving upwards. Well, I'm not drawing it very well. And above that unstable equilibrium, gene frequencies will go up and go towards the equilibrium here. I should draw the arrows smaller and smaller as they approach it. Of course, above, gene frequencies are changing down. There is no horizontal movement because those are different cases. But the interesting thing is below the unstable equilibrium, you go down. Which means that if you start out with too few of the locally adapted allele in a case where there really should be an equilibrium of it, if you start out with too few, they don't run into each other often enough to be selected strongly enough to overcome the migration. If you start out with a larger number of them, then they successfully establish themselves. That's an interesting fact. And in fact, what happens is when these two equilibria, when you get to a certain rate of migration, when these two equilibria collide at a frequency near but not exactly at 50%, there's a flash of light, energy is liberated, they annihilate each other. And to the right of that, or larger amounts of migration, the equilibrium is down here at zero. Too much migration, and it's lost. But the interesting thing is the collapse of the patch of adaptation occurs once the recessive allele has been driven down to about 50%, somewhere in the neighborhood of 50%. Some of the math is shown in the book, and you can find out what the exact frequencies are as if that makes a difference, which it may not. I don't know those cases, but it's analogous to this is a phenomenon known as, what is it known as? It's known as not chaos, it is that other thing. It'll come to me. There's a class of solutions of differential equations that look like this, and there's things like as you put strain on a metal beam that's holding something up, at a certain point the beam buckles under just a little bit too much strain, and suddenly you get sudden changes, and these are catastrophe theory. It's called catastrophe. This is a simple catastrophe. So there you get this, and I think this is roughly at the point where the migration rate is a quarter of the selection coefficient, something like that. Okay. You get similar phenomena when you have two populations, I'll draw those, that our selection is going back and forth between two populations, and the fitnesses, I'll do the haploid case, where big A is favored in population 1 and little a is favored in population 2. So you have locally favored alleles in both populations, different alleles, and then you feed in the migration. If those are so slightly different selection coefficients, we'll call them S sub 1 and S sub 2, then at a high enough migration rate, one or the other, depending upon which allele is more strongly selected, takes over. So that is, it's like each one is trying to invade the other one's patch and overcome it. and one of them finally succeeds. If you get a high enough migration rate, low enough, lower migration rate, you simply come to equilibrium frequencies less than one in of the favored allele in both cases. So again, patch collapse it hasn't been talked about very much in the literature. There's a little bit of, the first known cases are by J.B.S. Haldane around 1929, but after that it wasn't talked about much until like 1970s or later. So you're getting geographic differentiation with the favored alleles have it at higher frequencies, but the extent of that migration, of that differentiation, is a function of how much migration you have. So you have these interesting cases. They're kind of fun to play around with. To skip a little ahead, let me first see if I can show you, I forget if I have a graph of this, but I may, on the projector in back. Let's see if I can make that work. Okay, here we go. Yeah, we went through all these. Yes, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, that's fine. So, this odd thing that you're talking about reminds me of the Galapagos finches, so like Darwin's finches. Was that the case where like the migration was small enough that the adaptation that each finch was able to rise in frequency? Is that like a good use of this model?
It's related. It's not exactly that, because in the cases of the Galapagos finches, you generally have different species on. You often have different species on different islands. And even when you have species together on an island, they're not exchanging genes. Mm-hmm. But you can imagine, you can ask the question of whether, in such a case, is there a kind of speciation called parapatric speciation, which means essentially that genetic differentiation within a species, which is what this is covering, can be reinforced to become more extreme and finally result in two different species such that they no longer, they now have reproductive isolation and they no longer have gene flow between them.
Mm-hmm.
That is somewhat controversial, and when I've emailed to the great expert on speciation, Jerry Coyne, and Jerry tells me he doesn't think it occurs very often, much as I would like for population genetic fun reasons to have it be frequent. Yes?
The finches had something happen where there was an intermediate-sized beak, and that led to speciation.
I'm not sure if you're referring to geographic beak.
No, a beak.
Maybe, but I'm not going to go into that. Let me just try to... that's some part, a graph that's showing, actually, the case I just showed with where the equilibria annihilate each other. And here's for a particular value of M. This is the delta P, the change of gene frequency as a function of the gene frequency. So here's the equilibrium. If I can hold my hand, steady it up. You come down to it from above and up to it from below. But here's the unstable equilibrium, and if you are below it, you lose out. As the migration rate increases, this peak here gets lower, and you finally reach the point where it goes under the line. That's when the two equilibria collide. And then below that, everybody goes to the left, and the locally favored adaptation is lost. Let's see. Okay, I guess where we have to go now is stepping stone models. It will be helpful to look at those for a moment. In stepping stone models, which are, of course, idealizations of the messy reality of geographic distribution, you either have a line of populations and each one is imagined to exchange migrants in the same rate with its immediate neighbors, or you might have a two-dimensional square. Some people may say, what about three dimensions? And the short answer there is, it's theoretically possible. But I don't know of a real case of any organism that actually lives, is distributed geographically in three dimensions. Because you may say, well, what about the ocean? And the answer is, most organisms live in a relatively well-defined depth in the ocean and don't have separate populations below them and above them. So one and two-dimensional stepping stone models are relevant. You can set up a case. Let's see what we've got here. This is two populations. Yes, you can set up a case where you have a linear array of a linear stepping stone model. In this case, I'm showing a model with something like 16 populations. And you can have the pattern of selection somehow depend upon which population. You can imagine those populations are north to south, for example. And I just want to point to two cases and tell you about them very quickly. And one is where the selection coefficients change gradually as you move along the chain of populations. And there, you might have, for example, here's an imaginary piece of a stepping stone model. You might have two alleles with fitnesses 1:1 at a certain point, and then 1+S to 1, and 1+2S to 1, and 1+3S to 1. So this would be a case where the selection coefficient in the populations are different, with big A favored to the right and not favored to the left. In a case like that, what you get is a somewhat sigmoidal pattern, and you can see it on the graph in the back. Let me get the key to that graph. Yeah. The squares, I'm not sure you can see them at all from back here, I can't, but the curve that's uppermost on the left and lowermost on the right, it's symmetrical. And it shows you a sigmoidal change, and you pass through 50-50 right at the point where the fitnesses are equal. And the presence of migration means that there will be some rounding off of that sigmoidal curve. If you think about it, you think about first the case where there's no migration. Where there's no migration, the favored allele will win out in each population. In that these are imagined to be infinite populations. And so what you would get is a very discrete, you would get a pattern where it was zero till it reached the point where you switched over from favoring little a to favoring big A, and then it was one. So there'd be a sudden leap upward of the gene frequency. That's fine. But that's in a case with no migration. As soon as you put a little bit of migration in, it starts to round off the edges there. And you start to see some big A alleles existing. This one is dead. Just a second. There's flow of gene and there's flow of fluid and pens. You'll see basically a little rounding off of that because migration will bring in the other allele, and that will reach a stable state of equilibrium gene frequencies. The more migration, the shallower that curve will be. Okay, a pattern like that is called a pattern where either a gene frequency or a phenotypic character changes gradually as you move through a geographic area is called a cline. The name was given in the 1920s by Sir Julian Huxley. And so we're talking about the mathematics where you can work it out of clines. And the answer is, of course, the clines get shallower if the if the geographic region is a finite extent, you actually get patch swamping. That is, if the climate gets shallower and shallower, as it gets shallower and shallower, in a sense, the two regions are each exporting alleles to the other, depending on the details of migration rates, local population sizes, and strengths of selection. It could be that in this case, for example, the left-hand patch, if it ended where I show, at the left edge, might get swamped by alleles coming from the right patch at a sufficiently high rate of migration. Yeah?
So the x-axis in this case is decline, or it's migration?
I missed the first word.
The x-axis.
X-axis, I'm sorry, I didn't. Let's be silly and 10 degrees north. I mean, it's geographic location.
Oh, geographic location.
Okay. Now, you can think of another case. And in the other case, this my own terminology is the ramp. That is, the selection coefficients are gradually changing as you move along. The step is the other case people have looked into, where the pattern of selection is that selection is in one direction. Let's say, I'll even go 1 minus s there, and then 1 to 1, I'll make it a little different. Basically, what happens, there are two patterns of selection. To the left of a certain point, big A is favored. To the right of a certain point, little a is favored. I'm sorry. I said that backwards. To the left, big A is favored. Sorry, say it again. To the left, little a is favored. To the right, big A is favored, in this case. And that's the case we also see plotted here with the circles instead of the squares. That's the lower case. I matched the two so they would coincide as much as possible right through the middle. And so you can see that in the squares case, you're diving into the into fixation or into loss a little bit more quickly. Okay. It has the same properties, that the higher the migration rate, the shallower the climb. The two curves are different technically. In a moment, I'm going to show you a little more about what they figured out about their shape. But I want to make a point, and that is that real life is much messier than what I'm showing you there. The populations are not in a perfect line. They're somewhat different in sizes. They have heterogeneities of migration rate. There's a river goes through at a certain point. It's hard to cross the river. There's a nice piece of flat area where it's easy to move. So there's all kinds of local heterogeneities and local heterogeneities in selection. Real clines are noisier. In addition, you have genetic drift of the gene frequencies. We'll be getting into that, the math of that, the last part of the course. And you have sampling variation, because the samples you take in order to detect the differences in phenotype frequencies or genotype frequencies are finite, and so there's some noise from that. So with all those noises, real clines are much more likely to be messy, jagged, and have shapes that are not nearly so smooth. Okay, it is a mistake to go in and interpret every jiggle in that curve as deeply meaningful and indicating something about natural selection. Obviously, a lot of it will just be local genetic drift and sampling variation from your finite sample sizes. It's also going to be very, very hard, by just staring at this curve, to tell whether the selection pattern is gradually changing or suddenly changing, whether it's a ramp or a step. I claim that, no, you could think about doing it, but don't write a grant proposal saying you're going to do that, because if they have any sense on the panel, which is sometimes in short supply, they would look at it and say, are you sure you can tell the difference between, have you done some calculations, simulations to show that you can tell the difference just from looking at the detailed shape of the curve? And the answer will usually be no, you can't. you can't really tell the difference. Now, let me talk for a moment about the mathematics of this. These are calculated, the cases I'm showing up there are calculated by setting up the selection and migration equations as a whole series of equations, one for every population. And it contains migration in from the neighboring populations and then this local selection, and you set them up and you say, well, the solution to that set of nonlinear equations will give us the Klein shape. There isn't a formula for it, but what you do is you basically set, for that case, I set them up and I basically solved the equation. I think I may have just cranked them through many, many, many generations until they were no longer changing, and then those are the numbers that I plotted there. So people tried for more analytical solutions, and there were two papers on this. In the late 1940s, and one of them has particular interest because of another detail of the paper. One was by J.B.S. Haldane, and one was by R.A. Fisher. In those days, these folks, Fisher, Wright, Sewell Wright, and J.B.S. Haldane, dominated the field, and they did most of everything that happened in the field. So in a paper in 1948, J.B.S. Haldane said, well, let's imagine a continuum of populations, not discrete, not as in that case, a stepping stone. And so you have a continuum, and then you set up a set of equations for the gene frequency, and you get a differential equation approximating what's going on. And let me see if I get it right. Yeah, it turns out that in the case where, let's call this point zero, that's the geographic indicator, let's consider the step case, where big A is favored to the right, and little a is favored to the left, and let's make it symmetrical so that the favored to the left. So it would be 1 to 1 minus s here and 1 minus s to 1 here. So everything is perfectly symmetrical. And we have a continuum of time in which there's jiggling of moving of the individuals by a diffusion process. So it's not discrete generation steps. And a continuum in space, selection is continually occurring as well. I won't go over the details of the model, but just to say, the result of this is the differential equation that you can, let's see, if I, x is the geographic location. And you get an equation, something like that. By the way, the whole thing scales. It depends on the ratio of migration rate to selection coefficient. If you have both of those, you get it's still exactly the same case in this case. It isn't exactly in the discrete generations. And then he was able to solve this differential equation. And the solution is given in the notes. I'll just write it down here to show you that it is kind of hard to look at. P as a function of x at equilibrium, minus a half plus 3/2, the huge bracket, hyperbolic tangent of the square root of s over 2m, times x plus the inverse hyperbolic tangent of square root of 2/3, don't ask me why 2/3, let's call this another bracket, whole thing squared. And you look at that and say, it's not obvious. It's not obvious just staring at the equation or staring at the case. Oh, it's going to be hyperbolic tangents. You know, they're going to be squared and square rooted. Not obvious at all. It does predict things. It is a function of the ratio of S to M. You get the same curve if you have the same ratio of S to M. And it gives you, of course, a nice hyperbolic looking curve, but it's not exactly a logistic function. It's kind of close to it. And everything is fine. So there's a case here that you can solve exactly, okay, by doing these differential equations. The other case would be the one where instead of S, we had same equation, second derivatives equals, and P and a 1 minus P for the selection, but in here, instead of just a constant selection coefficient, if you made X a function of the geographic location, so it's SX, that's the ramp. S is linearly changing as you, instead of being a sudden switch. By the way, people might ask you, well, what's the, if you're going north and you're getting, your population is getting colder and colder, you'd think that selection coefficients would change gradually. But remember, what could happen there is to change, there might be broadleaf vegetation up to this point, and here's the point where conifers take over. So there can be a sudden change in some other biological distribution that is the biological basis for this case. This one, this was done by Haldane in 1948. R.A. Fisher got into the act. He did this case. And there's a very interesting, and he didn't succeed in solving it analytically, unlike Haldane, because it's a Harvard case. I'll take your question right now, so I don't have to interrupt the flow here.
I'm wondering if you could use this map to look at cooperation and competition as a function of spatial distribution.
I think that's too complicated for me to answer, and I don't know the answer. Let me just say something, a little bit of a sociological or historical point about Fisher. What Fisher was able to do is set up the differential equation and solve it numerically. So he showed what the curves look like for some values of M and S. And you can see, of course, it will again depend only on the ratio between M and S. But he did it in an interesting way. He didn't solve it numerically himself. He was walking across, just as Hardy had run into Punnett walking across the campus of Cambridge University. Fisher was at Cambridge University. He was walking across the campus. And he ran into a guy he knew named Maurice Welps. And he said, "Oh, hello, Wilkes, what are you up to?" And Wilkes said, "We've got this new computing machine that we've built." And what Wilkes had famously done was to build a machine called the EDSAC, you know, something like an electronic, discrete, something, automatic computer, anyway, which came online in 1949. About the same time as another machine built by Alan Turing at the University of Manchester, the MADM, the MADM, they were different in the way they both were part of a generation of early computers. There are said to be 50 different machines that have a claim to be the very first computer. So different people will have different opinions of what the first computer was. These two, Madam and EDSAC, are my candidates, and many people point to them, because they were the first machines that could take their program and have it put into the memory of the machine as a bunch of coded numbers, so that the program was fetched out of the memory of the machine in addition to the numbers that were being calculated. So they're the first example of stored program computers. They were electronic. They used vacuum tubes for their computation. They used mercury delay lines for their memory, a very strange technology that is interesting itself. Some of them used also decay of phosphor spots on the surface of CRT tubes. That was another early storage technology. But anyway, Fisher runs into Wilkes. Wilkes has just gotten working one of the, in this case, two earliest computers in the world. Okay. Now, the interesting thing about Wilkes's project, the EDSAC, was they didn't, the Madam machine came up, ran, and then they immediately took it down and started improving it, the hardware. So it was always coming up and going down with new hardware improvements. EDSAC, they kept going, and they tried out working on their techniques for something that came to be called programming. And there are many, many common ordinary things that you do in programming that were first done by Wilkes and his group in Cambridge University starting in 1949. Fisher says to Wilkes, "Well, I have a problem that I bet it can't solve." Okay, and Wilkes said, "Well, let's try us." And Fisher then showed them what the differential equation was and said, "Can you solve this differential equation?" And they sat down and programmed on it for a little bit, and they solved it. And so the paper published in 1950 in Biometrics, it just shows you the equations, it shows you what the gene frequencies are, and then in the acknowledgments it just says the numbers were computed by Maurice Wilkes and his students. But it doesn't say anything about the world's first computer. I claim this to be the very first application of computers to biology. If anybody can find one before that, you've got a very small window in which you have only the first few computers in the world and only months to find it in. So I'm pretty sure this one is going to hold up. It was mentioned by Fisher in his acknowledgments and by Wilkes in a paper that he wrote in 1975. So the first bioinformatics ever is computing the solution to this guy, which again comes out, you know, to be sigmoidal-looking curves that get flatter and flatter the larger the amount of migration. There's one other case that I'll just close on, and that is there actually was a slightly earlier use of these differential equations to describe spatial distribution of spatial clines in gene frequency. And that is a paper by very, very famous Russian mathematician, Andrei Kolmogorov. So there is a paper, Kolmogorov, Petrovsky, and Biskunov, in 1939. Now, Kolmogorov was like one of the most famous Russian mathematicians of the 20th century, one of the world's most famous mathematicians. He did many things. This is a lesser-known thing that he did. He was working in the Soviet Union where genetics came under suspicion and was repressed by under the leadership of the malign leadership of it was under Joseph Stalin, and it was under the crackpot, not Lamarck, what's his name? That crackpot, whose name will occur to me in a moment. Anyway, so you may wonder, well, this is population genetics occurring in the Soviet Union. Trofim Lysenko. And this is occurring just before genetics was suppressed. Now, Kolmogorov was always a very good survivor, so what he did was get out of the field and not get suppressed. He was important in mathematics. He continued to hold positions through the whole Soviet period. And whatever the political clouds, Kolmogorov had a way of emerging at the top of Soviet mathematics, and he did wonderful things. One of the things they did was to look at another spatial case, and that is simply having a region where the selection is the same everywhere. So let's say big A is favored. Again, I'm drawing a haploid case, but you know, the geometric case will work the same. And they asked this question. Suppose we plotted gene frequency horizontally, and X is spatial, and this is not a 1, it's a P. And we introduce a low frequency of the favored allele at some point in this space. Well, if you think about it, what will happen? At each point in the space, the natural selection will be increasing the gene frequency. Migration will be spreading it out. The result will be that this local patch of big A will start increasing in size and spreading left to right, further and further, if that's badly drawn. And finally, locally, it will start to get close to fixation where it was first introduced, though it hasn't got there yet further away. And if you wait a bit, what you will see is a curve to the left and a curve to the right, a climb to the right. And the climb to the left will be moving leftwards, and the climb to the right will be moving rightwards. And in between, big A is essentially fixed, or near fixation. So then what Kolmogorov, Petrovsky, and Piskunov in their paper, and also there's a paper in the same era by R.I. Fisher doing essentially the same thing. I think it was also in 1939. The number, the exact dates are cited in the book. So the question is, what is the rate of movement of that patch of favored stuff in both? It'll be the same in both directions. The answer is something like square root of m times s. So it means if you double selection coefficient, it's going square root of 2 times as fast. Or if you double migration rate, similarly. So it's a cute case. Differential equation mathematicians love to do all kinds of variations on this. There's paper after paper. It doesn't really connect very much with observations. You don't get very many chances to see this happening. Although it has, you know, people have found particular cases and measured the rate of movement. Yeah, we'll finish up with the questions.
I have a question regarding the continuous population.
Here.
So is there any way to distinguish this one versus the stepping stone model?
Well, the stepping stone one, if you take the populations closer and closer together, will start to approximate this. As they get more and more populations, more and more densely together, the spread of individuals by random diffusion starts to look more and more like what happens. So they do, one does approximate the other. But the continuum is the one you can get these nice differential equations for. The other one, you just have to set up equations, one per population, and crank them. But then you can get the numerical solutions, yeah.
What about the ramp? Is there like a ramp version of that one?
This one, this is the step version, this is the ramp version. So there, the X in here means as you go to the right, as X gets larger, the S is multiplied. And as X goes to the left, X gets negative, and selection is in the other direction. Whereas this is the ramp, and what you have to do is put a plus or minus S here, depending on exactly where you are. I neglected that. There's the one equation to the left and one equation to the right. They differ in the sign of S, and they match in the middle. I think we're out of time. Talk to me after. So we'll pick up here. Now, what we're going to do next is we get to inbreeding, which is really a step on the way to genetic drift. And that starts next time.